Ordinance 794, summer 2008. This June 21, 2008, lecture 3.1, usability testing number one. So I noticed there were some questions about the deliverables today, so we might as well see and start with there any more of those. Any of those, maybe water with a dam, but so you would have annotation and five software to use, which could be the full form or shorter, as they indicated. And I think I turned that sequence around in my email and in my new notes. So the evaluation checklist version one, because supposedly you have learned from reading those additional reviews, you have learned more criteria. Then the summary sheets for 3 to 5 programs. So that would apply the evaluation checklist, as was said in the conversation, not in full detail, just sufficient to make a decision which of these 5 or 3 or 5 programs you think is the best, and you therefore want to go ahead and evaluate in more depth. If you're in a real life situation, you cannot evaluate, well, maybe you could evaluate 5 in depth, it's really important, but you certainly couldn't do 20. And there may be 20 on the market. And so you may need summary sheets for 20, and you select 3 that you're going to evaluate in depth to compare, and that's one strategy. Or you could select one that seems really the best and evaluate it in depth, and if it suits the purpose of the organization, then go with it. What's the disadvantage of that second strategy, where you evaluate only one in depth and not 3?
What's the one that?
The disadvantage.
Disadvantage is you might have missed out on something else. You're kind of
surviving
it. What are you doing?
Right. You're
not liking it.
Your summary sheet may not give you really enough information to. I mean, it may give you enough information to discard 15 and say one of those 5 is really it. It may not give you enough information to select which of those 5 should be selected. So that would be a problem with that approach. Those are cheaper. In decision making, the approach to sort of go with the first that satisfactory has a name. It's called satisficing, as opposed to optimizing, where you really want to find the best.
That's the thing I have the biggest problem with for all the ILSs. Most of what came up when you're looking for reviews were one paragraph blurbs.
Yeah.
You know, Destiny's upgraded to 8.0 and it now has this, this, and this. It's a great system. But I'm still having a hard time. I haven't really found any reviews that are more than just that little paragraph.
I found a few, but not as many as you want us to. And on the program I'm most interested in, I found better than a paragraph, but the big checklist of head-to-head comparisons and stuff like that, I found like one of those about other older, more classic systems, but nothing on new tools or EasyBib or Citation Machine or the, kind of newer, smaller ones. They're all small reviews. Some of them talk about features, but they don't have tables, they don't have, scores, they don't have any of that official sort of stuff.
Most of the ones I saw didn't even have prices, or it was just kind of a... So I've spent a lot of time looking, and I have, 4 or 5 little ones for this. There's a resource that's not full text online, that's a magazine here, periodical here, that I'm going to check out after class, that had some reviews of stuff when they were first put out in the 1990s.
Okay. You did that outside house. I don't...
Yeah.
We found lots of literature, but not reviews. So,
yeah.
I mean, it wasn't. It was sometimes they talked about features of certain systems, but it wasn't really review.
I feel like I made my choice of which program based on the other literature,
yeah.
as opposed to just solely on a review. But it was more a compilation of all the other things that I read about the program.
All the literature so that you can find on right. all the comparative and what who's using it for you. You get a pretty right. good idea, but it's not like one review laid it out at all.
Okay. Now, if you have software that has broader use, like work processing or spreadsheets or general graphics programs, you will find reviews in PC Magazine and PCNet and other places like that. If it's more specialized, if you're lucky, you may find reviews in journals that deal with this kind of thing. So there may be a Journal of Library Automation.
There's
library technology review, yeah. So I mean, among your sources, I did say that you may need to look at journals in the subject, and I can't give you a whole bibliography of all journals in the subject. They sometimes have reviews. If all else fails, try to see whether there's some technical support forum, some listserv that deals with the program, and many programs have that. So you have sort of a user community, and they have
blogs.
They have blogs or a listserv or.
That doesn't satisfy on your evaluation criteria.
It does
score very poorly.
You have to. Here, realize you have to use what you can get, and they will possibly give some strength, but usually, of course, they will concentrate on things people are trying to do and couldn't, and then they ask a question. But there's some information you can find out from those. I think this is missing some.
There's one review that sounds like it may be a real review, and I can't find it for free. It wants money. And I was trying to make, I thought, well, if there's just this one, maybe I'll pony up for just one.
So there's an article that.
It's in the Charleston Advisor, and there's Hawthorne Press and Charleston Advisor that for some reason both published a couple of reviews, one on NoodleBib and one on EasyBib.
Okay.
And $35 is what they want for it.
Unless you have it here in the library.
I went through the research port. We don't have it electronically. I didn't see, and it usually comes up, and even if they don't have it electronically, it'll say that you can find it in the library. It didn't come up.
I would check the library catalog.
Check the library catalog for the trust.
The other thing you want to do is do a Google search.
I did.
For the title.
And the author.
You did that.
I found references to it. They have little extracts from it, which is how I know about it in the first place.
Okay.
And I dug all around it. I found a couple of others that way by Googling, and you find what journal it's in, and then you go through research port, and you find that journal. And you can do a general search on a pile of journals with what looks to me like the correct search terms and come up with nothing. But then if you go to the right issue, volume, year, and page number, there it is. And so it's like, okay, so what part of my search wasn't working? I can't really, and I'm not a newbie at searching, but it's like doesn't seem like it always works the way I want it to. If you know exactly where what you need is, sometimes you can find it.
Not all of the spider might not find all these things. They're inside.
Yeah.
A site. And the site may say, don't index
me. It may not be in the title, or may not be one of the tag terms or whatever.
Now, Google indexes full text, but they don't get all documents.
No, but it's usually in things like LexisNexis and academic search.
Oh, you
search. and Eric or whatever it is that I, you know, that has access to that journal. And you can do, you can say a search within this journal, but I don't think it goes down into each issue and looks at text. I think it's looking at tags.
That could be.
Yeah.
You have to know how
irritating.
How each search engine works.
Yeah.
But just as a general rule, if a publisher wants money for an article, half the time you should do a search for quotes for the title. You will find it somewhere. Maybe the version once before the final edit, or but usually something that's sufficient. But not always. Sometimes there's just...
I'm tracking it through Montgomery County Public Schools, because they must have done an evaluation selection process. I hope they did. I hope they did through the program. And I'm wondering whether they have access, because I've got a call in to them saying, have you got anything I could look at? I work for you. So I might get something out of direction.
Yeah, it's...
I think they made a good choice. But I don't know how they
make their choice. Alright, so let's start with what we need to do, page 55. And so spend 7 minutes and just write down what you remember on usability heuristics. I think could one of you sitting at the end of there come up here so Melissa has a easy place to sit down. She will come in a minute. So. Thank you. Okay. So before we review this, what's the purpose of usability heuristics?
User.
Should have a set of guidelines. What would be the alternative if you didn't have any usability heuristics and you wanted to evaluate something for usability?
Everyone
has decided. Now you want to see whether it works.
You could do testing and things like that, but with usability heuristics, you don't need hands-on testing as much. You can just apply these basic principles, and it's the same for each software.
So you would hope that once you adhere to those usability characteristics, those programs would come out better on the test.
Yeah. I don't necessarily agree that you don't need to. Ideally, you should.
You still need testing.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you hope that by keeping these in mind when you're designing a system and trying to combine them, as you said.
Okay. So the idea of a heuristic is to, if you don't have complete knowledge, at least to get somewhere. What was one, I think you lost somewhere in the mountain, you don't have a map. You sort of have to rely on general principles, what might be a good way to get down, which absent knowledge, use some heuristics. And one heuristic is you follow any stream you find. You follow it going down. That might eventually get you out of the mountain more likely than if you just walk in some random direction. And so that's the idea of heuristics here, to get something usable more likely than if you just do whatever occurs to you. So what did you come up with writing?
Consistency. One of the major ones that he repeated in just about every chapter everywhere. Consistency.
Right. Now, if something is difficult to do, if it's better if you do it, follow this 10 times, there's a question. So consistency always assumes
it's a better way to do it.
You have a reasonably good way to do it that you use consistently. Okay. What else?
It's the user language.
Okay.
Don't use jargon. It confirms your users will understand.
Right. This could actually be jargon if it's a program.
Well understood jargon.
That is directed at a specific user group. Yes.
It depends on who your users are.
Yes.
You've got a system that's meant for RNs to use registering their patients' information, they're going to know a lot of terms, but you use their language. You don't use the system developer's terms.
You must have written down a lot more.
Minimalist design, but aesthetic, I think people would say. Don't overdo the interface or the, with too many bells and whistles that aren't really going to improve the use for the site or make it easier for the users or, are relevant even to do that a lot.
The more stuff you put in there, the harder it is to find it.
Yeah, I think he called it narrow dialogue with no extra. Not a lot of extra information
that you
didn't need,
but
it's hard to go through.
I mean, that's a general principle for any kind of communication or even conversation. There was a philosopher, communication girl named Grice, Grice, and he's most famous for Grice's Maxime. It means give the hero or the user exactly what's needed. Neither less, so to give them everything that's needed, nor more. Don't give things that are not needed.
That kind of goes along with I think you're balancing it against another one, which is limiting the memory load. like you don't want to give them too much, but you want to give them enough. You don't want to make your user have to remember too much from prior screens.
Right. Right. That's exactly what's needed. That's an important principle. In this, I mean, exactly what's needed, of course, is a question you have to decide case by case. Microsoft, actually, I'm not sure how to do it in the, actually in the new world interface, maybe even worse than the old, but on the menu choices, from if you click on one of the top menu items, in the default, they give you three or four options of what to do. And for me, half the time, what I want to do is not there. So I immediately change the options to always give me all pieces there. And so I think they help on that. Now, I don't know. Maybe it depends on the user. Maybe some users can only handle four things. No, I can handle nine and quickly find the one I need to use. So the application of heuristics then becomes debatable, and some may depend on the user.
Yeah. System feedback. The system should be telling you what's going on and not
leaving you hanging.
Yes. That's
User testing that should be, if at all possible.
Yeah, but
you need to have user testing.
Yeah, but that's not a usability heuristic.
Okay, you're looking for the specific
heuristic. Okay. Is just principles you apply in order to maximize your chance that user testing will come out well. Let's see, I mean, I
Exit.
Yes.
Error handling.
Have documentation easily available. And I mean, preferably context sensitive.
The usability heuristics, when reading Nielsen, it's coming more from the angle of the developer, of you should build programs that are usable in this way. And in that sense, the usability heuristics mostly apply to the interface. So these kind of interface, some of them go a bit deeper than the interface, but it's the interface that they're mostly talking about. And then, so that's the developer's point of view. And then the evaluator's point of view, again, all you can really see is the interface. So again, the usability heuristics is sort of a guideline for building or evaluating the user interface, right?
Yes, it can be applied on both places.
I found that a little confusing because, of course, we're not building them, and it kept talking about doing this and doing that. Well, we're not doing this or doing that, but I guess we're checking to see whether somebody else did this.
Well, it's true. Nielsen's book is written from the developer perspective. Most of it. However, exactly the same principles apply to evaluation.
Yes. So
when you do your summary sheet,
yeah, you're evaluating for whether the developer did this.
And if you don't find reviews, but you find some demo or some other way to see how the program works, you could apply usability heuristics to evaluation.
Yeah.
So any principles that talk about the quality of anything, you can apply to design and production of whatever it is you produce, and you can apply to evaluation. Washing machines, calls, the criteria the consumer's reports does in evaluating a call would serve equally well for a car manufacturer to build the car to those specifications, or for a car tester to test the car whether which of these specifications it meets. So they're usable both ways. So they always update those usability heuristics, and page 56 has sort of an updated view. And is there anything that we haven't talked about? Match between system and the real world. Well, that's the use of language, but it's also more general.
Yeah, I noticed when you compare this list to the one in Nielsen, it's a one-to-one mapping, but he's changed the order around and he's using slightly different words.
Right.
It's not like it's a different list, it's the same list.
So, another way looking at measuring system in the real world would be at icons.
Yeah.
That the icons look like the real thing if they're designated objects. But there's also a much more deeper meaning to that. It goes well beyond the interface, and that's the example we did is the spreadsheet. So the match between how the program does things and how people do things naturally in the real world. So accountants had spreadsheets to manipulate the numbers, and the software could be many different designs for an interface how to manipulate numbers and relate different numbers to each other and so on. And the spreadsheet is a natural way to do it. So.
It's
a cognitive map in how the program does it in the the sample midterm exam question that had to evaluate the program to prepare meals or menus. So the person who guides that should get into the workflow, if you will, to arrive at a meme and see whether we can match this. And you may find there are two ways to decide what meal to use. Either have some criteria for the meal and then you go out and buy the ingredients. Or you have the ingredients, you want to prepare a meal from them. And those may both be real-world workflows. So match with the real world would, in this case, mean for the program to be able to do both approaches.
So when you're trying to specify something, to do that, what you're doing is a task analysis of what are the different things that you want it to do.
Yes.
And what are the different inputs that you want. So really, it's a sort of a feature list at that point. That's not a usability heuristic. That's more of a list of tasks or features that you want the program to perform.
Yeah, but you could apply this before usability, so in that sense it's a heuristic.
Apply what?
You could apply the task analysis to your software design before you do user testing.
Yes.
And you are likely to get better results if you do it that way. And the rest of them, I think, are already so 57, 58 is more like this whole thing is more like a reading. It's more an elaboration on those heuristics, and it's applying them to the web. And I think they're good comments. So it's a reading. So let's look at metaphors. And here again, I'm going to have you shut down some thoughts. And then we can bring, maybe 5 minutes is good enough for that, and then we can bring them together in the discussion.
What metaphors are good for a particular type that we're working on?
That would be good, because it will be useful to have examples.
Okay.
So these are examples or generic principles on using metaphors. We talked about it a little bit already, but we'll talk about it a little more. And so examples actually would be good. This is page 61. All right, so let's see, what, why use metaphors?
It's easy for a user to understand something that they already understand, the concept in the software that they already know, so they can apply what they know to learn how software works.
So we using a structure or some operation, the concept from one domain to use that knowledge in a new domain. So do you have some examples from your software so we could look at metaphors and we can see what knowledge is being transferred from one domain to the other?
Well, I guess mine, I thought the classic one is card catalog, but most kids have never seen a card catalog, so I kind of thought that it might be more analogous to, more like, because my tongue's not working today, an Amazon search for them. The idea that you can put in some subject stuff or the title or an author and it comes up with what you want. And ideally, if you have a very good system, a picture and a description and some similar stuff.
So this is library catalog system. That's an Amazon search sufficiently different? Or is it?
I don't know, but it's something.
Or is it just the same?
It's very similar, but it's something most of my kids have done.
Okay.
So.
Whereas catalog, you know,
yeah,
you know what it is. You know, something different anymore.
Put them on Facebook's catalog and say, okay, it's just like shopping on the internet. Tell us what you want.
So that would go beyond Amazon.
Yeah.
To a shopping. Well, well, to a shopping. I don't know whether the kids actually do shopping websites and how they select things on a shopping website. In there's also there's a general principle. How far away is a metaphor? And is it still a metaphor, or is it just transferring knowledge from one system doing the same thing to another system? So one word processor wouldn't be a metaphor for another. A typewriter, in a way, would be a metaphor for a word processor. A bad one, by the way.
Right, because you use all those other things that you can do in a word processor that you can't do with a typewriter, and, you know. So a new user to word processing, if there is any anymore, or 20 years ago, or whenever that would be, you know, wouldn't know about the, you know, copy and paste, and, you know, spell check, or whatever you can get on a word processor, that you can't have a typewriter. So, I mean, I don't think it transfers, it doesn't transfer completely. You know.
It transfers erroneously.
Right.
Because people, you probably don't remember that point, but I remember the people who would put in hard terms at the end of every line. Because that's what they do in a typewriter. Because at the end of the line, you press.
Yes, my mother still does that. She uses email, but she always gets the return.
So then when you want to do revisions or whatever, all those hard terms get in the way. So that's a metaphor where it doesn't work well. Shopping may be sufficiently different from, I mean, still searching, but different from a catalog, that it qualifies as a metaphor, sort of. And so you could look at a shopping site. What kind of knowledge would be transferred from shopping to searching for books?
Subject information. Keywords.
Yeah.
Keywords.
Any other specifics, if you know what it's called specifically, or brand name or title, you know, you can put that in. And that then once you get it, you might get a whole list of responses that kind of match, and you're going to have to search through those somehow, you know, and whether it
coming up with the idea that they might be able to be resorted, or you might be able to narrow your search results depending on the systems you're used to.
One piece I picked out from this is known item search, as opposed to I just have a general idea of some product I want to get. I want this shirt. I've seen it on TV. It has a name, brand name, and this is what I want. As opposed to, I want to buy a shirt and it's when we're on the beach or whatever. So the distinction between known item search and subject search is probably something that I have done in shopping on the web. That's something that we transfer to the catalog.
It sounds like a recommender element that they users have.
Some catalogs.
Certainly could be transferred. Some catalogs could do that. That's almost more like a metaphor that the design of the catalog should use.
That's catalogs would use that if, for instance, if you've got pseudonyms. They would say, well, do you want books by this author's other name as well?
That's sort of authority list which the catalog might have more of than the shopping. Like a mender is more like if the actual children at that school who checked out this book or they checked out this book or who looked at this book or looked at this book, that could be put in, but it's more like a metaphor for use by the designer. It's a feature that designers might want to incorporate into the OPAC based on its success. We assume it's successful on a shopping site. So other examples of metaphors that from your different systems.
In the citation managers, the ones that have the ones with notes features and to a lesser extent the ones without the metaphor of a sticky note, sometimes you think of a citation as a sticky note because you are attaching it to the piece of data, so they've all got this little sticky note that's attached to the information that you're sharing. If you do notes in the system, you can think of it as, some of them are sticky notes where you put them in a document somewhere, and some of them are more like index cards where you have a deck of them and you can shuffle them into order. And there are sticky notes on the index cards because they're attached to citations and stuff. So that's a sticky notes and index cards.
Right. And what knowledge is being transferred from the paper version to the computer version in that case?
The characteristics of being attachable, being arrangeable.
Okay.
Being sortable and retrievable and
different.
I mean, it's pretty simple, but it's still, that's what it's, the fact that you can attach something.
Right. And those are actually useful tools in the computer environment. The metaphor in that case is a good one. The cards, maybe we have to generalize. They're more manipulable and sortable and they arrange on the computer than they are in the real life.
Sort of
yes.
Criteria, right. Still, you can keep thinking
about
things you rearrange.
Okay. What about,
Well, for content management systems, because there's most of them have a clear separation between content and display, for people who are allowed to edit the content, they display the word processing. A word processor, so they know that they just have to type information and it'll be, they're only typing content. And it allows them not to get confused with, how to modify the display because they can't do it. They also know how to use word processors, so it's relatively straightforward.
What is the metaphor there?
Well, you're going from using a this management system to just if you're a content editor, you're basically just pulling up a word processor. word processor instead of, you know.
So it's not actually a word processor. It's not word, but it just looks like it.
It looks like how
people could think of it.
Mm-hmm. So the metaphor is that the content management part of this is like a word processor.
Yeah.
Okay, because I could see I could think more in that context of a metaphor that wouldn't work, where people are used to producing documents, final documents, with whatever tool they have, and they formulate the text to the audience, the document, they get pictures, but they focus just on that one document. And somebody else writing documents the same thing to a different audience for a different purpose will focus on that document. Where the content management system, you need to actually relearn that habit. You need to learn that you're producing just little pieces of content, and then those can be reused. The reusability is a concept new to the content management system. It's not in the old how do we produce catalogs and websites and other documents for our audience workflow. So the using what you learned on producing documents will not work in the content management system. You actually have to relearn the method. So I think that might be an example where metaphors are bad. And even if they... Maybe some formatting works like in a word processor, but more often than not, it may work more explicitly. I mean, you have to put more explicit codes to how to arrange things, and it may not be as specific as a word processor. It may be more sort of, I'm just doing a document in LaTeX and it's awful because there's no specific. You just have to, it's all commands and sort of in the text. And if somebody's really versed in that, they may be able to do good documents. I think a content management system person, a really good document designer, needs to learn those commands, and they need to learn how to create a file that produces a nice looking document. But it's a lot easier than to start from scratch because they're reused. So I think in a content management system, you have to really revise your thinking on how to produce documents considerably. And so sticking with the old workflow may not be the thing to do. Okay. Now in the game program?
You know, I was sitting here trying to think of some, and I couldn't think of one that... I couldn't come up with one this morning that was, you know, applicable. I recalled several things, like terms they used, but that I wouldn't call them metaphors. Like they use one of them. I don't even remember which program it was. Uses, you know, has a icon for share. Well, not even an icon, just the word share that to upload to their website to share there. But
okay.
It's not really a metaphor.
No.
And so I couldn't really come up with one. They use like the word sprite.
Right.
Yeah, it's like a little image. So that's the kind of things that I was thinking of, but it's not a metaphor per se.
So I have to use a lot of graphics. A lot of the metaphors that I think of are the natural ones of why is it the way it is. It's like when you do the animation thing, is there sort of a metaphor of the sheets of acetate that, you know, each one's a little different from the last one. Like the drawing board, would a drawing board be a metaphor for what you're doing, or do you color stuff in, so you maybe have the metaphor of the
right and
the pen as opposed to the fill that you do later. I mean, usually these things are built based on how we used to do it, and so they're often, like with animation, you don't have to do it in repetitive screens, but that's the way you had to do it when you were doing it on acetate, so I think that's the way they usually do it. Maybe they don't anymore.
I don't know. I mean, I thinking of like the drawing options that come up. I mean, there's some, you know, a pen and that sort of thing that come up for them to draw with, a stamp to copy.
The stamper tool.
Right. Yeah, like that's, you get the stamp, they have the stamp under the copy.
That's the metaphor.
Yes.
That reminds me of some of those drawing programs that you can use to make pictures that often comes with your Microsoft Office suite.
Mm-hmm.
They have a pen that comes up and you take it and you move it around and draw with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you paint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Spray paint.
And that's what it's whatever, that's what makes me feel like it's all blob in the eye. But it's like you would take a pen just like you would if you were coloring or drawing with a pen.
Yeah, the pen is a metaphor, and if you want to move the pen from one place to another without drawing,
you have to pick it up.
You have to pick it up.
Right.
So there's pen up and pen down.
Such a Photoshop pen tool does not correspond to a pen.
It does not use that metaphor?
The pen tool is very weird in Photoshop.
Yes, what?
It's like you can do curves and vectors and things, and it's confusing in Photoshop. So it's not actually a pen like writing, it's a pen like making them.
The backwards use of metaphors, and when you're developing something that's going to replace the task that people have been doing a certain way forever, you got to be careful to try to map between the way you've always done it and the way the developer is going to fix it. Because people will make all kinds of errors if you change it on them. If you say, oh, well, I've got a better way of doing this. It's got nothing, it's got nothing to do with pens and stamps and paper. It's revolutionary. Your users are going to look at it and not know how to use it. So developers go to a lot of trouble to try to follow the physical metaphors of how people actually do things.
And I think they also appeal to the age group in which they want to do that with. I mean, if you've seen the way Office has come out, 2003 was a lot of pull down menus. 2007 is icons all over the place. And they're trying to get to the people who know how to use icons.
So we're evolving our metaphors because mm-hmm. we've been using computers for enough years now that the next generation of kids think of, icons or something they know about. So, 50 mm-hmm. years ago or 20 years ago, if you came out with something with icons, you'd have to teach it from scratch.
And they're too frustrated with pull down menus. They just want to
sit down and
click on the icon next to the end of it.
If the right icon is there. I can only use Word 2007 because I know how to get to the pull down menu. Because usually the option they give me are not the one they want.
And I've told kids now, well, the icons like pull down menu, if you roll over it and wait a second, it'll give you the list of things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's a metaphor from pull down menus, which only got invented, 20 years ago.
Right.
Anyway, but it's entered the our vocabulary of things that we can say it's like this.
In the game, I don't know how about the game, but there's the other metaphor of a toolbox.
Yeah.
Where you have a box full of shapes and maybe
actions,
then you can and you can just drag them, and you can take them out of the toolbox and put them somewhere. The only difference is the real toolbox is that taking it out doesn't remove it. It's just a if you have a toolbox full of game components for a real game you make, if you have taken out this triangle that bounces,
it's gone.
It's gone. Whereas in this case, but that's sort of easy. to learn. But that kind of game would be easier to do than if you have to click somewhere and say, now I have to type in some word to have this box. Or making actually a lot of the direct manipulation is sort of metaphor. Increasing a window by moving the mouse, that's something you do in the life, especially in something.
Well, the games that are harder are the ones that aren't quite as intuitive, like the Sims games. You got to move the people around, and you can't figure out how to get the cursor to move the people around. And you got to go through all the menus to get help. It isn't like you pull out a tool, it bounces, and you know what's going to happen to it. So I think the games with the toolboxes work a lot better. They're more intuitive.
It's my first time use a lot of the games out there now that are like The Sims. You have to be willing to put in the time to learn how to use them.
Yes.
The fact that a lot of console games now start you on a tutorial.
Yes, they do.
The first thing you do, your first mission, is a tutorial of some sort.
Maybe that's why they're weak, so popular.
Yeah, it's so
intuitive. Just at all, like you actually used to do things.
Even as far as the one, they have one that's cow racing that is completely like even.
Well,
some of the racing.
Steering
well, but the steering wheel, you still have to, it's like you push the button to go. The one, you roll forward to go faster, you roll it back to slow it down, you pick it up to jump. So it's completely, you know, you steer like this, and you're racing cows. Yeah, you know, so completely, you go forward, you know, move the thing forward. You want to go slower, you pull back.
Well, but that.
And it's, you know, that's you can pick it up and, you know.
But that's a special purpose piece of hardware.
Yeah,
right.
Well, it's the Wii controller that you use for everything.
But
for the
Wii. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the sensor in it, Wii controllers are.
But you couldn't play this game on your old, or whatever.
No.
It's a piece of hardware that's making all these inputs out of the motion of the thing.
But
it's your file names, which is give up.
But are there a lot of games that, I mean, sort of the adventure type games where you do things where you have to read instructions first?
I think it's less read and it's more that they start with a tutorial.
Yeah.
The
tutorial?
The game itself, it just goes in slow motion.
Yeah, you walk up to the first, if it's a fighting one, you walk up to the first person and it says, in order to swing your sword, press this button and then this button.
Okay, and kids use it.
Yeah, and they're... They're used to that.
Because this is sort of opposite the ultimate thing that nobody reads manuals.
Yeah.
Well, they think it's part of the game.
And so they don't know that they're learning, they're just doing.
I see. Okay.
A different thing to that, which I think is very surprising, is all the Game Boy games, all the Pokemon stuff. They sell a guidebook for each one, $15 each. It looks like a thick magazine. And my kids have actually paid the $15, and after a while I said, okay, you get the program, I'll get the book. But they get these things, they've got a stack of them, because you know, if you've got this thing that shows you what each level has on it, you know, you can be a more of an expert user.
And those with Pokemon is all about the stats and stuff.
8 to 12-year-olds who are actually flipping through looking for Midnight Mountain, you know, and they're looking in the index. That's like, wow.
No, it's a good way to get them to read.
My middle child learned to read on Pokemon.
Could you push that on button again?
But that's unusual. That's an unusual thing where they're actually going to documentation. But that's the documentation
is not
serious.
And
there's
people who want to do it. The reason they're doing it is motivating content.
Book too, though.
Right, and it's motivating in that way. It's presented in a way that's appropriate, age-appropriate.
But they're still doing But they're still doing what Nielsen said. They wait until they get to the point where they need to use it before they look it up.
Yeah.
say most of them won't sit down and read it from cover to cover. Oh, maybe no, they get to that point, and then you get out the index.
They get lost. They get lost, and they die in the same place.
Okay. So it's getting, is that core usability to get lost, or is it designed in the game?
It's different because it's a game.
Yeah.
It's not like you're trying to have the quickest way of getting through the mountain. I mean, it wouldn't be any fun if it was easy.
Okay.
The obstacles are desirable in this case.
Okay.
The magazine is kind of that user interface, so that they, when they get frustrated, it keeps it fun.
It helps coach you to be an expert, so that you can. And some of the kids don't use them, but most of them love having these guides. They buy the guides at the book fair, at the middle school book fair. We had guides and codes, and things with cheat codes where you could put in, the developers would put in some special code where if you put this in, you got 500 rare candy and this thing sold out like that. We ordered another box, so the kids were buying this. Of course, you want them to buy, the Narnia series, but what they're buying is Nintendo cheat codes. So.
But they have to read to
but they
find
have
it.
Read.
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue with it.
Okay, so this goes sort of to next week, and we'll talk about learning and education programs. But let's take a break now. When we come back, there's page 62 and 63. There are two lists from Nielsen that I think could be arranged better, so we're going to work on arranging those better, which will be a good way to get more of a handle on them. I will just guide you through some usability methods kind of things, and but before we start that, after we do 62 and 63, if there's any question on the Nielsen book, I mean, clearly we cannot go over the entire thing to get there. We can just sort of make you think a little bit to at least get some of these things arranged a little better in your mind. But if you have any questions or how things apply to your program or to your task, we can discuss those. Because then in the afternoon we'll sort of cover very similar ground from the perspective of web usability. And therefore, I think that will serve to reinforce it all. Okay. End of this lecture.